The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Well, we turn to a somewhat different topic now than what we were considering in that first hour. And I want us to think through, in the next hour, Calvin's preaching on Job. That's going to involve us thinking about Calvin's understanding of the book of Job, but perhaps more broadly than that, Calvin's understanding of the doctrine of providence. And interspersed in that, perhaps something of the methodology and purpose of preaching in Calvin. So there are several things here that we need to be thinking about. I can't really speak about Calvin and his preaching on Job without drawing your attention at least to some seminal work done in this area by Susan Schreiner from the University of Chicago, in several sources, not least The Theater of His Glory, a book that was published some time ago now, but more recently, and once again in that volume that I mentioned earlier, edited by Donald McKim, Calvin and the Bible, she has an essay on Calvin and Job, which is quite magnificent in terms of its comprehensiveness. So I would draw your attention to that. Calvin was, of course, no stranger to personal suffering. Writing just before he died in April of 1564, writing to Bullinger, he says, "Although the pain in my side is abated, my lungs are so full of phlegm that my breathing is difficult and short. A stone in my bladder has been very troublesome for the last 12 days. Add to that our anxiety." Now, if you've read Bousma's biography of Calvin, you'll know that he makes untoward use of Calvin's anxiety, almost making Calvin out to be, I think, bipolar and schizophrenic. I think it's more of a biography of Bousma than it is a biography of Calvin, to be honest. Anyway, Calvin says, "Add to that our anxiety, for all remedies have so far proved ineffectual. Horse riding would have been best," imagine, to get rid of a stone in the bladder, "but an ulcer in the hemorrhoid veins tortures me even when sitting down or lying in bed, so that I could not bear the agitation of riding. Within the last 3 days, the gout has also been very troublesome. You will not be surprised then if so many sufferings make me lazy. I can hardly be brought to take any food. The taste of wine is bitter." Well, I cannot begin to envisage Calvin as lazy. I can't get that into my head. But living in the 16th century brought about, I think, for Calvin a particular focus on his health. And that's just one of several examples in his letters where he draws attention to his bodily ailments. Interestingly, I've never come across a single reference to it in his preaching. And the preaching on Job takes place 10 years earlier in 1554 and 1555. And to my recollection, there isn't a single reference to his own personal sufferings. Some of these issues that he refers to, hemorrhoids and nephritis and gout and ulcers and severe headaches and so on, all of these were part and parcel of Calvin's, certainly his latter life, and would certainly have been true, I think, in 1554, but he never draws attention to that in preaching. In addition to that, I would draw attention to Calvin's magisterial exposition in a pastoral way of Providence in Book 3 of the Institutes, where he envisages the Christian life in terms of cross-bearing and self-denial. I doubt there's a section in all of Calvin's writings that equals the summit that he reaches in describing the Christian life in terms of cross-bearing and self-denial. He makes a comment in his exposition and commentary on 1 Peter, in 1 Peter 1, I think it's on verses 10 and 11, that God has so ordered the church from the very beginning that death is the way to life and the cross the way to victory. For Calvin, one reaches glory through suffering. That resurrection is a consequence of, first of all, death, and therefore that analogy of death followed by resurrection is for Calvin, as we saw earlier in his commentary in Romans 6, for Calvin that becomes a paradigm for understanding the Christian life. Resurrection, new life, comes on the other side of death and mortification. And therefore, for Calvin, there is a peculiar relevance. You're not at all surprised, that Calvin would take up the book of Job. Not simply because had Calvin lived long enough, he probably would have preached through the entire Bible. But it's not at all surprising that he takes up Job to preach on. From the very start, in the 1530s, actually before he writes the first edition of the Institutes, he wrote that volume, you remember, Psychopanikia, dealing as it did with soul sleep, the heresy of soul sleep, mainly coming from Anabaptist quarters. Calvin, in that volume, had raised Abraham and Job as models of discipleship, models of what it means to live the Christian life in this world. There's one particular reference in that volume of Psychopanikia where Job is singled out as a model of life in the tension between the now and the not yet. Calvin, of course, was not unfamiliar with the sound of mobs in the street threatening to throw him into the Genevan lake and firing muskets and naming their dogs, Covin, after him, not as a compliment, you understand. On his understanding of Job, in particular, we see many things. We see, a model of how to, well, at least in one sense, a model, not necessarily a model for us to follow, but a model of Calvin's style of preaching. Why it is, for example, that he preached 159 sermons as opposed to what I might recommend, a dozen sermons on Job. For Calvin, and let me say just as an aside, because we do need to be reminded of it, from 1549 until he dies in 1564, Calvin preached two sermons on Sunday, and then every analysts differ here, but every weekday of alternate weeks. And T.H.L. Parker argues that at least on the week when he wasn't preaching, he may also have preached a sermon on the Wednesday. The maths, or math, as you say, doesn't quite compute unless we add that extra Wednesday. But in any case, in the space of 2 weeks, he has preached 10 sermons, 10 full sermons, and we complain at one or possibly two in the course of a week. It's quite staggering, the sheer consistency of Calvin's output, sermonic output, let alone other things that he did in the course of a week. They were, of course, taken down by Denis Ragunier as an amanuensis, taken down in shorthand from the French. Some of these then would be transcribed into full written French. Calvin would glance at them. There is very little evidence of any editing work. Calvin was initially quite reluctant for these sermons to be published because of the lack of editing, and perhaps for Calvin representing a genre in preaching that was quite different from the lectures that he gave. We know that Denis Ragunier then, in the course of these 15 years from 49 to 64, took down over 2,000, I'm citing from memory now, but 2,041, is that the number? But just over 2,000 sermons. Some of these have been lost. They were taken down in shorthand, in the 19th century, various libraries in which they were held, including Geneva, sold them for the weight of paper to make room for other things in their libraries, and at least 1,500 of these sermons were lost. Some of them, a few of them, have been rediscovered. There is a supplementer, Calviniana, that 8 volumes, I think, have now been published, containing the transcribed versions of some of these sermons, and some of these have now made their way into English. I think, for example, of the wonderful work of my colleague, Doug Kelly, in transcribing sermons from 2 Samuel into English just a few years ago. This past year, the Banner of Truth published a volume on Acts, at least the first few chapters of Acts, transcribed as they have been from the French shorthand of Denis Ragunier for the first time in English. Calvin then takes up Job in 1554 in February, and preaches through weekday sermons. His practice was to preach New Testament on Sunday. Occasionally, in the second service on Sunday, he would have preached on a psalm. But for some reason, never from the Old Testament, apart from the Psalms. Old Testament sermons were always on the week day. Calvin viewed the book of Job as a book essentially about God. He says in the very first sermon, God has such sovereignty over his creatures as he may dispose of them at his pleasure. That sounds like Calvin, and it is Calvin. It's Calvin in his opening sermon on Job, that God has such sovereignty that he may dispose of them at his pleasure. And then he goes on to quote what I cited earlier, it is a great thing to be subject to the majesty of God. Now, in dealing with the book of Job, Calvin has to deal with, of course, the issue of suffering. And in particular, the concept, and the somewhat difficult concept, of innocent suffering. It is one thing to suffer because of divine retribution. It is one thing to suffer the just deserts of our sin. It is another thing to suffer when there seems to be no cause. You remember in Job chapter 1, God himself, in response to something that Satan has said, seems to say that he has entered into this suffering of Job, that Job is suffering without cause. Without cause. And that seems to concern Calvin a good bit, understandably concern Calvin a good bit. How can God be just? It's an issue of the justice of God. How is it right for God to inflict suffering in some form or fashion? God is involved in all that happens to us. The sovereignty of God, Calvin's understanding of God's providence in our lives, means that things don't just happen willy-nilly. They don't just happen without cause. There must be some cause. But how can God be just and seemingly afflict Job with this massive suffering without cause, for no fault then of his own? Job is a good man. Not that Job is sinless, but God himself, on three occasions in that opening prologue of Job, the first two chapters, he's introduced to us as a godly man, an upright man, a man who feared God and, in the King James translation, eschewed evil, shunned evil. That is not just the writer of the book of Job's assessment of Job. That is not Job's assessment of himself. This is God's assessment, God's divine disclosure about Job himself. So we are told, Job of course himself is not told this, but we are introduced in the prologue to a view from behind the scenes that, in to all intents and purposes, Job is not suffering due to anything in himself. The issue then of so-called innocent suffering. Now, in the first few sermons, and I think it occurs in sermon 5 of Job, and remember, Calvin preaches in the Lectio Continua method, picking up the next day on where he had left off before. So each sermon contains a paragraph or two of a summary of what had happened before he continues again in his expositional method. But I think it's in sermon 5 that Calvin says that we have a good key to the unlocking of the book of Job in this. That Job had a good case, but argues it badly, and that Job's friends have a bad case, but argue it exceedingly well. And that's the key for Calvin that unlocks the book of Job. Now, what is the bad case argued well of Job's friends, Bildad, Eliphaz, and Zophar? And it is, of course, what Calvin calls, in one place, the doctrine of instant retribution. Now, Calvin recognizes that the doctrine of instant retribution is true, that there is such a thing as instant retribution, that God sometimes does inflict punishment in the sense of suffering that is a direct and immediate response to wrong behavior on our part. He cites, for example, Hebrews 12, chastisement for wrongdoing as an example of instant retribution. God deals with us then as sons. Perhaps the more notable examples of that are the case of Uzzah and the ark. When Uzzah stretches out his hand to stabilize the ark as it's making its way back eventually to Jerusalem, God strikes him down dead. Calvin, in one place, refers to Ananias and Sapphira in the New Testament in the days of apostolic blessing, post-Pentecost, in the immediate wake of Pentecost. Here you have an example of what you and I might consider to be a white lie, a trivial statement about the price of real estate that the church had no business knowing anyway. And God strikes them both, husband and wife, down dead. That's not just old covenant God. That's not just the God of the Old Testament. That's the God of the New Testament. That's the God of Pentecost. That's the God of the early church. So there is such a doctrine as instant retribution. And Calvin in no way wants to undermine not just the reality of that, but the way in which pastorally we must contend with that. I think Calvin would say that when we suffer, we ought to ask ourselves, am I suffering because I'm being punished, because I'm being chastised, because God is rebuking my sin? And that for Calvin would be at least one of the consequences of, say, his exposition of Hebrews 12. But that is not the case, at least initially, that is not the case for Calvin in the book of Job. God himself tells us that Job is innocent. Innocent in the sense that there is no immediate connection between any sin or failure on Job's part and the judgment or the suffering that has come upon him. Now, secondly, let me say, not only do we see Calvin dealing with the issue of innocent suffering, but in the second place, we see Calvin dealing with the more broader issue of providence himself. Now, in the sermons, it's interesting, and it would be interesting perhaps on another occasion to ask, you know, how contemporary were Calvin's sermons? What use did Calvin make of illustrations from his own time? You know, there's no newspaper from which Calvin can cite, and in the 159 sermons, there are only a couple of references to events that are transpiring in the more immediate context. There is one tangential, perhaps more than tangential, but he doesn't actually name him, reference to Civitas. The Civitas affair was taking place during this time while Calvin is preaching on Job. And there is, at least in one occasion, a reference to what is undoubtedly Civitas, but he doesn't, interestingly, mention him by name. But other than that, Calvin is almost divorced from the day-to-day affairs that we might see as headlines of the daily news. But he does refer to theological and philosophical and apologetical concerns of the church of his time. He mentions the Epicureans, for example. And he does that, I think, because for him, the Epicureans, which had the Epicurean philosophy, I think, had revived itself in the 16th century, posing, as it did, a doubt on God's governance, and particularly a doubt, therefore, on the idea of providence and of God's control over every aspect of life. And so you find the term Epicurean thrown out as almost an epithet, a critical epithet, in the sermons on Job because of their criticism of sermons and their criticism of worship and their criticisms of religious ritual and their criticism of the church, and in particular their criticism of providence. He sees as part and parcel of that a return to the pleasure doctrine, which is almost akin to what you and I perhaps face in questions about leisure, or you say leisure. Almost an obsessive issue for us in the 21st century. What is the Christian view of leisure? Calvin had a place, I think, for leisure and the admiration of the arts, for example, in his theology. But you cannot imagine Calvin having a day off and visiting a local museum or listening to the equivalent of an orchestra. Calvin's what we might call his Protestant work ethic far outweighed his concern, I think, for leisure in the way that you and I have a concern for it today, partly driven, I think, by societal demand for a recognizable period when we do not work. Well, all that, be that as it may, Calvin does address in a broad brush sort of way something that he calls the Epicurean philosophy. He also, interestingly enough, addresses it too in Book 1 of the Institutes when he expounds the doctrine of providence. And in some ways, you could assign the sermons on Job as an anti-Epicurean statement on Calvin's part. Calvin is concerned to show that God is not idle, that God is not just a spectator, and that God is constantly involved in creation. He upholds creation. Nothing happens without God willing it to happen, without God willing it to happen in the way that it happens, and without God willing it to happen before it happens. There's a crucial verse for Calvin's understanding of Job. It occurs at the very end in chapter 42 and verse 7 when God is speaking to Eliphaz, and he says to Eliphaz, "My wrath is kindled against you and your friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has." And that becomes a key verse to interpret the book of Job. Job has spoken essentially what is right concerning God, and Eliphaz and his companions have not spoken what is right. Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar have maintained the transcendence and righteousness of God. They have upheld the sinfulness of men. They have upheld the truth of the justice of an order of society, the reality of the doctrine of providence, everything that they say is true in itself. They are exponents of conservative doctrine. They are to the far right, Calvin would say. They're not espousing heresy. They are, in fact, upholding truth. But they did that using, as a blunt instrument, the tool of instant retribution. And for Calvin, they made one crucial mistake, that God's justice isn't always visible, that there is at times an invisibility to the manifestation of the justice of God. And all suffering, therefore, is not necessarily divine punishment. Now, Zophar, for example, says to Job that if Job's life was pure, his life would be brighter than the noon day. The wicked would fail, and all way of escape would be lost to them, Zophar says. And for Calvin, that means Zophar interprets the justice of God in an entirely visible way. And there is no room in Zophar's view of justice for something that is hidden or something that is invisible. For Calvin, Zophar's initial words in chapter 4 and verses 7 to 9, "Who that was ever innocent ever perished," Zophar says. Who that was ever innocent ever perished. Now, of course, for Eliphaz, who makes that statement, "Who that was ever innocent ever perished," that leads, of course, to the view that if somebody perishes, if somebody suffers, it means that he's not innocent. He must be guilty. "You reap what you sow," he says. "You reap what you sow." Now, that's true, of course, and as we know, Paul takes up that very statement and uses it positively in his epistle to the Galatians. "You reap what you sow." We use that doctrine in a philosophy of child rearing. We teach our children there are consequences for actions. We reap what we sow. If we sow immorality, if we sow sin, there are consequences, and we can't gripe, we can't grumble at that which we reap if that is what we have sown. Now, Calvin commends Eliphaz for defending the justice of God. God is sovereign. God is the creator. God is wise. God is good. God is just. But God is also inscrutable. And God is also beyond our ability to comprehend and understand. There is a hiddenness in God. There is, because of at least two considerations. One is the consideration of human finitude. We are finite creatures. What we know only a little. What we know only in part. And God is omniscient. God knows everything. We have no category by which Calvin says to even understand what it means to know everything. We know things discursively. We know things in sequence. We know things often by temporal considerations, one thing after another. But God knows all things all at once. And there is no category for us to understand that. Now, Calvin could become controversial here. And there is a moment in his exposition of Job 4:18. Job 4:18, and I paraphrase, Job 4:18 says that even the angels are impure in God's sight. Now, what does that mean? Even the angels are impure in God's sight. Well, perhaps the fallen angels are impure in God's sight. Those angels that rebelled along with Satan himself are impure in God's sight. But the Vulgate translation, and Calvin was certainly aware of and certainly seems to have read Gregory's exposition and commentary on Job and argued that was a reference to fallen angels rather than to angels in themselves. But Calvin somewhat demurs from that understanding, and he says, and it becomes important because he cites it. Look up in the Institutes Job 4:18, and you'll find early in book one of the Institutes, he cites this text, and to which he says, there is a righteousness in God that exceeds the righteousness that is revealed in the law. There is a righteousness in God that exceeds the righteousness that is in the law. And it's Calvin, well, for me, it's Calvin perhaps at his most worrying. There are shades of, I think, medieval nominalism, perhaps, just at that point. Is Calvin suggesting, in his view of what's called double justice, that even if you lived an absolutely pure, sinless life according to the revealed law, you could still be held guilty in the sight of God because there is a law that is unrevealed. There is a righteousness that exceeds that righteousness which is part of the revealed law of God, to which then even the pure angels are subject, and even they then are impure in the sight of God. That's a somewhat worrying concept, and you see a reference to it in book one of the Institutes. There's probably a milder interpretation of what Calvin is saying, but you see him, especially in his sermons on Job, suggesting that even if Job was as innocent as the driven snow in the sight of the holiness of God, he is still a sinner. And if that is what Calvin is arguing, and it's unclear, that somewhat undermines the logic of the book of Job, that there is such a thing as innocent suffering. Now, Calvin then begins to look at the contribution of these three friends. Calvin notices the extent of Job's suffering. He has lost all 10 of his children, lost all of his wealth, and in the second cycle of suffering in chapter 2 of Job, he has also lost his health, and he makes an interesting, if perhaps 16th century, comment on Mrs. Job when she says, "Curse God and die." He refers to her as Diabolus Matrix, and you don't need to know any Latin to know that's not a compliment. gives probably, along with Augustine, Diabolus Adjutrix, I think Augustine referred to her as, probably the worst possible interpretation of what it is she's trying to say. Calvin says, Job's friends only have one song, and they sing it to death. That's a quotation there from his sermons. They only have one song, and they sing it to death. And their song, the lyrics of their song, goes like this, that Job must be a sinner, that he must have sinned in some way, whether a big sin or a little sin or a sin of his youth or a sin that he's forgotten, but in one way or another, to uphold the stability of the universe and the justice of God and the moral integrity of the created order, it must be the case that Job is reaping what he has sown. Well, that goes well until about chapter 23 or so, and you get the sense in Calvin's expositions that Calvin is losing patience with Job. He begins in chapter 23, and perhaps, and I'm speculating here, but perhaps anticipating the contribution of Elihu in 33 to 37, he begins to be critical of Job in a way that he wasn't critical of Job. In the first half of the expositions, he is always defending Job against the three friends. But by around chapter 23, he's beginning now to lose patience with Job himself, saying perhaps, nobody is that innocent when Job protests his innocence. And it leads, I think, to the importance for Calvin of the contribution of Elihu or Elihu in those chapters 33 to 37 of Job. And 32 to 37 of Job. Now, irrespective of what you and I may make of Elihu, and you may have your own interpretation of Elihu's contribution, I've somewhat held personally to a view that says that Elihu began well but finished badly. I somehow get the sense in chapters 36 and 37 that Elihu reverts to an instant retribution view, and therefore whatever good contribution he makes in the beginning, he sort of undoes at the end. That's not Calvin's interpretation. Howell Jones, my fellow Welshman of Westminster Seminary in California, just published a commentary on Job in the Evangelical Press series that John Currid edits, and I notice he takes a Calvin view of Elihu, arguing very strongly that perhaps Elihu's contribution is the key to the book of Job, and therefore the reason why God does not criticize Elihu. God criticizes the three friends because they have not spoken what is right concerning him, but he does not criticize Elihu. Now, arguments from silence can work both ways, as we're often told in polemics on baptism, perhaps. But for Calvin, and this is Susan Schreiner's point of view in particular, Elihu is Calvin. Calvin is Elihu. You want to know what Calvin's view is, then just read what Elihu says. I think it gave for Calvin the right to criticize Job. Reading what Elihu says gave for Calvin the right, and you see it emerging in about chapters 23 and following of Job, the right to begin to criticize Job. Elihu understood sin. He understood the impossibility of merit. He understood the justice of suffering. He understood the inability of anybody to to plead against God. He understood the necessity to give praise to God. Even at one point, Calvin credits Elihu with an understanding of the doctrine of imputation. Elihu understood that God's will is the rule of justice. He understood the inseparability of the divine attributes, that you can't pit one attribute against another. And therefore, Job wrongly accuses God of being a tyrant, of employing his sovereignty over and against his justice. Now, too long an issue, but in the 16th century, for Calvin, this was an important issue, theological issue. The doctrine of absolute power, potentia absoluta, was God acting according to that God could do as he wanted to do, irrespective of his justice, putting the sovereignty of God over and against then his justice, the specter, if you like, of absolute power. And you see Calvin dealing with that issue and denying that issue, and advocating that Job was doing just that. And therefore, Calvin sometimes puts Job into the mindset of certain medieval characters advocating a view of absolute power. What is it that Elihu demonstrates? Well, several things. That suffering is pedagogical. That the purpose of affliction is to teach us and instruct us. It makes us appreciate our frailty, our indebtedness, our dependence upon God. It leads to repentance. It's pedagogical. It's medicinal. It's instrumental in our discovery of wisdom. Sometimes, Calvin says, the purpose of suffering is unclear, hidden, inscrutable. There is what Calvin calls the special providence of God that afflicts for this purpose, to demonstrate to us that God, whilst he may be known, cannot ever be known fully. We might conclude that God acts without reason. God's own statement to Satan in the prologue, that Satan had made him act without reason. That's how we judge it. Now, God never acts without reason. There is always a reason. That reason may not be known to us. And as far as life, as it were, in our reality and our perception of reality is concerned, it appears as though God acts without reason and without cause. Which means, and for Calvin, this is, I think, the heart of the book of Job, it means that we must trust him. It means that we must believe in his goodness, even when that goodness cannot be seen, and when that goodness isn't perceived. And therefore, when Calvin comes to the whirlwind speeches of God in 38 to 42, Calvin is, I think, at his most magisterial. Now, you can read these sermons. There are some Leroy Nixon in the 1950s, there was an Erdmann's volume of 20-something of these sermons translated, possibly, I think, by Leroy Nixon himself from the French. There was an English translation done in 1574, a decade after Calvin had died, and in Elizabethan English, somewhat torturous, of course, to read. But if you can avail yourselves of that translation, those sermons from 38:1 to the end are Calvin, I think, at his most magisterial. As I was hinting at last night, Calvin, in particular, I think, identifies with the struggle when God says to Job in 38:1, "Who is this that darkens counsel with words without knowledge? Be the man, dress up for action." Calvin notices that the Hebrew verb is a Hebrew verb drawn from the field of wrestling. Job had been asking for a fight, an epistemological fight, to be sure. But God is saying, "Yes, let's fight." And Calvin sort of waxes eloquent when God says, "I will ask you, and you will answer me." At the seeming 180-degree turn, Job is the one who's been asking questions, demanding that God give answers. And when God finally does speak, the rules for this epistemological fight is God is going to ask the questions, Job is going to provide the answers. And Calvin says, and I'm paraphrasing now, but he says it's almost as though the rules are sort of loaded from the very beginning. You know, in the very establishment of the rules, there is no possibility of winning this fight. So we ought not to be surprised at the first question, you know, "Where were you when I created the earth?" And you want to throw up your hands in horror and say, "Well, that's not fair." You know, what kind of question is that? The dice have been loaded from the very beginning. Calvin wouldn't employ a gambling metaphor, you understand. And therefore, when it comes to Behemoth and Leviathan, however you interpret those, Calvin sees them as a whale, a sea creature, and an elephant. There is in that very question, why did God make these creatures? And the answer is for his own glory. And for Calvin, you know, this is the heart of the purpose of suffering, to make us understand that we have no right to the knowledge as to why we suffer. If God provides us with that knowledge, all good, but we have no right to it. God is free and just to withhold from us the reason for our suffering. We must trust him and understand that this too is to be for God's glory. Calvin, of course, notes the importance of Satan and the involvement of the powers of darkness in all of this. It seems, Calvin says, that God is hidden and that he withdraws from this world, that he separates himself in order to abandon it completely, briefly, except when God makes us experience his providence and we are convinced that he governs high and low. We are, as in the night, in an obscure time. We do not see God's judgments according to our understanding. There are some times that are hidden from men, but known to God. That is, when God delays his judgments and does not execute them immediately, it is indeed an evil temptation for the faithful when things are confused in the world and it seems that God does not get involved, but instead that fortune rules and dominates. There are times, because of suffering, when we are tempted to think that we are simply the victims of chance, the victims of blind forces that leads to skepticism and cynicism on our part. And therefore, suffering for the godly who understand that God has so ordered the church from the very beginning that death is the way to life and the cross the way to victory, suffering should lead to meekness and reverence and especially patience. Because without patience, we cannot adequately and properly serve God. He says in Sermon 7, when they can modestly moderate themselves and hold such a measure as they cease not to glorify God in the midst of their trials. That for Calvin is the height of piety, patience and trust in the midst of the severest forms of adversary. Well, let me just close briefly in a minute and just remind you of how in practice Calvin employs that theology and theodicy of the book of Job to the five prisoners, you remember, in Lyon, who eventually were martyred, having been captured and taken to Lyon. Calvin, remember, writes several letters, and in the end he says, thus, humbling yourself under the guidance of the Spirit of God, answer soberly according to your knowledge, following the rule of Scripture, I have believed, therefore I speak. Yet do not let that stop you from speaking frankly and plainly, fully persuaded that he who has promised to give you a mouth and wisdom, which all your adversaries shall not be able to gainsay, will never fail you. In leaving this world, we do not go away at a venture. You know not only from the certainty you have that there is a heavenly life, but also because from being assured of the free adoption of our God, you go there as to your inheritance. That God should have appointed you his son's martyrs is a token to you of superabounding grace. Well, that's just one example of how Calvin employs his understanding of Job in the context of suffering. Thank you.